Good afternoon and welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Scott Greeson. I'm the director of Friends of the Eel River. The Eco News Report is an exclusive feature of KHSU brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center, publishers of our regional environmental newspaper, the Eco News. And don't forget, you can find this show and other KHSU public affairs shows on the audio archives page at khsu.org. Our topic for today's show is lamprey. They're a wonderfully bizarre group of fishes that remain relatively poorly understood, even though they're among the older forms of vertebrate life in our world. Lamprey resemble eels, though they're not closely related, and it was the abundance of lamprey that gave the Eel River its name. Lamprey were a key resource for native peoples of the North Coast who continue to harvest lamprey today. However, lamprey populations are sharply depressed from even a century ago, and it appears to still be in decline in a lot of areas. Figuring out even some of the basic information about lamprey seems to be a key step in their conservation. My guests today are Damon Goodman, a fisheries biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Arcata office, who coordinates lamprey conservation efforts in California; Stephen Coleman, who's the environmental director for the Wiat tribe and is currently working on an Eel River Pacific lamprey passage assessment and limiting factors analysis. We'll get to what that means. And Vincent DiMarzo, a member of the Wiat tribe who also works with the tribe's environmental department. Welcome, guys, to the Eco News Report.
All right. Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Scott.
So before we get into the nitty-gritty, how did you guys get interested in lamprey? Go ahead, Stephen.
Okay. I got interested in lamprey mostly from working with the Wiat tribe, and lamprey are a very important species for the tribe. And so as we're looking for ways to become more involved in Eel River restoration projects, lamprey seemed an ideal species to focus on. And mainly, I've been learning more about lamprey as we've been doing the project.
Cool. What about you, Vincent?
Being a tribal member, I've fished for lamprey all my life, so I got started at a pretty early age with lamprey, and from there, I've always just had interest in the species.
And I've been working with lamprey for about a decade now. When I came on to the graduate program at Humboldt State University, my thesis advisor brought up the idea of working on Pacific lampreys, and ever since then it's been a focus of my work and actually outside of work as well.
Lampreys suffer a bit from not being, well, cute or furry or conventionally beautiful like maybe a big shiny salmon is. In fact, lampreys seem to a lot of folks like something out of a horror movie. Damon, maybe you could describe lamprey and sort of how they're put together for folks who aren't really familiar with the fish.
Yeah, I guess I'd have to disagree. Once you see a lamprey building a nest with its mate, building a red in the river system, it'll turn your heart around. So I see lampreys as a charismatic megafauna, which may be different from other folks. But there's several key differences that separate lampreys out from other fishes in the streams around here, including they lack paired fins, they're jawless, which is pretty unique, and cartilaginous. They don't have bones. But one of the real unique characteristics that pull lampreys apart from other fishes is their ability to climb. These guys can climb near vertical surfaces, actually vertical surfaces, which opens up a whole different world in stream systems because of that.
And they do that using these sucker mouths. I don't know what the right word is for those.
Yeah, it's their suctoral disc. It can be used to latch on to vertical surfaces or near vertical surfaces, and as they climb up, they latch on and they're actually resting, and they do this kind of unique movement where they'll grab and hang and then pulse and move up and can work their way up fairly large barriers to other fishes, and it's no problem for a lamprey. This has an effect to change how they're distributed in stream systems, which is kind of cool, and how we think about anadromous barriers. So for example, I'll take a local example, like in the Van Dusen River, steelhead have an upper limit of anadromy somewhere around what's called Eaton Roughs, which is downstream of Highway 36. When we look at lamprey distribution, they're over 12 miles above that, probably even farther above, because they're able to use that climbing ability to open up new areas of the stream that aren't accessible by salmonids. Another example I'll bring up is like the Middle Fork Feather River. We've been doing kind of an assessment of distribution of lampreys throughout the state. And the Middle Fork Feather, the historical steelhead distribution before Oroville Dam was constructed, was about 1,015 feet in elevation at Bald Rock Falls, which is kind of like, it's a 30-foot granite slab, a waterfall. So lampreys, no problem making it above this barrier. And actually, they make it up to our highest recorded specimen in the Middle Fork Feather is around 4,254 feet. So that's a fairly big difference. And if you look at the habitat above that, they're probably making it even higher than that. So around, maybe we're estimating around 4,900 feet. So it's kind of a unique aspect of lampreys that separates them out from salmonids.
So in the big picture, it looks like lamprey overlap with salmon and steelhead pretty neatly. And as you're outlining, they're in the same river systems. They seem to use similar habitats, at least for spawning. What can we say about the relationships between lamprey and salmonids? And, you know, how are they different? How are they the same? And maybe we could talk a little bit about their life cycles and ecological roles.
There are a few differences in their life cycles. And that's one of the things that's just coming to bear recently, because a lot of the study has been on salmonids in the past, and a lot of assumptions have been made about the life cycle of lamprey based on the life cycle of salmonids that are turning out to not be as accurate. One of the most interesting things is that it appears that they don't necessarily return to their natal streams, but will use any river system up and down the coast, which makes their genetic distribution much wider. And like you mentioned before, one of the studies that we're doing is a barrier assessment, and Damon spoke on that quite a bit. But there are differences in the types of barriers they can get over and they cannot get over. And in the past, a lot of the barrier assessments were done in view of salmonids without considering that they might be passage barriers to lamprey. As Damon mentioned, they can climb many things, but lamprey are very poor jumpers. And so if there's a perched culvert where there's any kind of distance between the top of the stream flow and the culvert, that's going to prove to be a barrier to lamprey.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's the case that we see quite often, is that anthropogenic barriers, oftentimes salmonids will get higher than lampreys, and then it's the opposite case in natural situations. In particular, I'll bring up the example of salmonid passage facilities. Vince, you want to touch on our visit to the Van Arsdale fish ladder?
Yeah, recently we got the opportunity to head down to Van Arsdale Reservoir and talk with Scott Harris with California Department of Fish and Game, who runs the fish ladder there. And recently they have done a blackwater release in an effort to get young of the year salmonids to outmigrate to the sea. And when they released the water, they kind of had an unexpected visit by about 500 lamprey, attempted to climb the ladder, got stuck in the trap, and then had to be carried above the dam. So it kind of opened their eyes to the needs of passage for lamprey and how they differ from salmonids. After that, Scott Harris was pretty excited about getting down to the hardware store and getting some equipment to retrofit the fish ladder so that he could better help lamprey to climb the ladder.
Fascinating. So actually, part of my question goes to the idea of, you know, when we look at the different runs of salmon between Chinook and coho and steelhead, you have species that have different needs in terms of how long they need to be in freshwater. Coho are spend a year in freshwater, while Chinook are going to move pretty quickly downriver and into the ocean. Lamprey, on the other hand, seem to spend quite a bit of time in the freshwater environment. Damon, what does that mean in terms of their vulnerability to the kinds of human impacts we might create?
Yeah, and you know, maybe I'll start by just describing the basic life cycle of the Pacific lamprey. They're anadromous, similar to salmonids.
It means they run to the ocean and back.
Correct. So when they start their life history, they hatch out of eggs in nests or reds, very similar to salmonids, and then they move to depositional zones where they'll create burrows and they filter feed for somewhere between, it's estimated, 5 to 7 years that they spend in that type of an environment.
And we're talking about things that look like a worm, really.
Yeah, they do look similar to a worm, and it's pretty neat. They don't have eyes, they don't have teeth. All they're doing is sitting there in the sediment, filter feeding. after 5 to 7 years, then they'll transform, and they go through a fairly drastic transformation where they develop large eyes, a suctoral disc, teeth, and they migrate out to the marine environment. In the marine environment, they go from something about the diameter of a pencil to something about, you know, a couple feet long when they migrate back into the freshwater environment. At that point, they'll spend a year in the freshwater environment developing their reproductive organs and then spawning the following year. So because they have such a long residence time in the freshwater environment, they're really tied to the conditions and consistent good in-river conditions to be able to be successful in their life history strategy.
So what might affect lamprey that, for example, salmonids wouldn't be quite so vulnerable to?
Well, it varies by salmonid, but desiccation events are a really big deal. You can be knocking out over 7 year classes of lampreys in a single desiccation event.
So when you dry up a stream, you know?
Sure. Yeah, when they dry up a stream. Yeah, exactly. So things like that, they're highly susceptible to that. And because in their amacete or larval form, they're tied to depositional zones and fine sediment, the idea has been introduced, well, you know, lamprey habitat needs are contradictory to salmonid habitat needs. In the salmonids, it's, you know, always reducing the amount of fine sediment in a system, but that's not the case. Lampreys need clean spawning gravels, just like salmonids do. It's not any sediment that's fine sediment that's good for them. They need oxygenated sediment that's sorted properly, so they need functioning freshwater systems to be able to complete their life history, just like salmonids do.
So just one last point on this general theme of ecological relationships between lamprey and salmonids. One idea I find particularly fascinating is that juvenile salmonids seem to feed on these amacetes on the juvenile lamprey as they're coming down, but then adult salmon become a food source for adult lamprey, and it seems like you've got a very complicated relationship between these two sets of species.
Yeah, we're just starting to get a handle on the ecological roles of these different species and how they interplay. For example, these amacete colonies, in some of the systems at certain times of year, they could comprise the highest biomass of any fish species in the system. And they're in the sediments, filter feeding the water, so cleaning the water column and, you know, providing that service to the system. And then during high flow events, they get, you know, fine sediments mobilized. They'll move into the water column. And then salmonids can prey upon them. And so, yeah, there's a lot of complexity to these ecological roles that these different fish species play.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Eco News Report. I'm Scott Greeson with Friends of the Eel River. I'm talking with Damon Goodman from the Fish and Wildlife Service, Vincent DiMarzo, and Stephen Coleman, both from the Wiat Tribe. About a decade ago, a group of conservation organizations filed a listing petition under the Endangered Species Act with the Fish and Wildlife Service, asking the agency to list 4 different species of lamprey. The agency declined to go forward with that petition, saying basically that there wasn't enough information. Maybe we could talk now about some of the things that the tribe and other entities have been doing to try to fill in the gaps in terms of what we know about lamprey. Stephen, you want to take a crack at that?
Well, one of the things we're doing with this project is trying to fill in a lot of the data gaps in what is known about lamprey, but at the same time doing some real-world restoration efforts, like I said, with the barrier remediation study and hopefully getting a chance to alter some barriers. And we've been working with Stillwater Sciences in this and developing a life cycle analysis and a limiting factor analysis.
So what's a limiting factor, just to be clear?
A limiting factor is trying to look at the life cycle of the lamprey and trying to determine where they're most pinched, and so what has been causing the decline. Because anecdotally, it's been seen that they've declined over the years, but they're notoriously difficult species to study. We don't know where they spend a lot of their life, and they're hard to find. They move at night or in events when the water might be too cloudy to actually see them. So the limiting factors analysis, and it's just really the beginning phase of it, is to try and get an idea of what the greatest potential harms are to the species, whether it's invasive species, they're preyed upon by the pike minnow quite a bit, whether it's habitat alteration, loss of habitat, barriers, or if it's even things that are happening out in the ocean environment, which we know very little about. But because they spend so much time in the sediments and gravel, it seems like any disturbance to that habitat could have great effects on multiple generations of the species.
Damon, do you want to describe sort of the larger picture of lamprey research in California and how we're trying to fill in the gaps?
Yeah, what I'll bring up is an effort that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is facilitating called the Pacific Lamprey Conservation Initiative. And it's an effort that spans the historic range of Pacific lamprey distribution in North America from Alaska down to Southern California and into Mexico, into Baja California. And what we're doing is reaching out to stakeholders that are interested in working together with us to conserve lamprey populations and better understand what are the threats and current status and trends of populations of Pacific lampreys.
I'm glad you raised that issue, because that was where I was going next, is what can we say about how populations of lamprey have declined? Do we have any kind of even rough estimates of their former abundance and their current abundance?
You know, there is very few population monitoring stations along the entire coast where there's historical counts of Pacific lamprey. There's very few. For example, the Winchester Dam in Oregon is one of, that's probably the best example of a historical lamprey count that we have, and that shows kind of an exponential decline in numbers. Some of the best information that we have for this area, traditional ecological knowledge from tribal fishermen, such as the Wiat tribe. And Vince, if you want to discuss some of that information.
Yeah, I just wanted to touch on the importance of traditional ecological knowledge and how all up and down the West Coast, it has been an important source of information for estimating lamprey populations. I've witnessed myself in the last decade a huge decline in lamprey numbers, and just the amount of lamprey that I've been able to harvest has taken a sharp decline in recent years.
And you're hearing the same thing from other folks up and down the West Coast?
It seems to be the same from Washington to here.
And, you know, one of the ways we're looking into this as part of the Pacific Lamprey Conservation Initiative is to understand the distribution of Pacific lampreys, both historical and current, and then comparing those. What we've done is compiled all historical vouchered specimens we can get our hands on from, we surveyed 20 museum collections around the country for lamprey specimens, and then looked at the identification of those to get an understanding of making sure they're actually Pacific lampreys. And from that, we can paint a picture of where Pacific lampreys were historically, before the construction of dams, before the alteration of habitats and this. And it seems that they were fairly well distributed throughout California and in streams that have connection to the marine environment. When you look at the construction of passage barriers alone throughout the state, it paints a much different picture to what's even available for Pacific lampreys to inhabit since the construction of dams and other fish passage barriers. So those are some of the alternative ways we're looking at how lampreys have changed through time, their distribution.
Vincent, I want to get back to tribal use of lamprey for a little bit. Folks who are fans of the British royal family may have noticed that Queen Elizabeth was given a lamprey pie on the occasion of her Diamond Jubilee just recently. And folks who watch the Game of Thrones TV series, you see the characters eating lamprey pie pretty often, but it's not something that European Americans often eat. Could you talk a little bit about how tribes use lamprey? And I've read that it's viewed as a medicine as well as a food source.
Okay, well, traditionally we've always harvested lamprey. As far as I know, it's always been an important source of food for us since time began. We harvest them in February and March and April, and they're a big staple of our diet for those winter months. A neat fact about lamprey is that pound for pound, they have four times the amount of protein that salmonids do. So it's extremely important for fattening up for the winter.
How do you cook them?
We traditionally cook them on redwood sticks over driftwood fires right on the beach. That's the best way to do it.
Another interesting component of that, too, with the lamprey having such a high nutritional value, is that they serve a great role in the ecosystem. Just about everything eats them, birds, sea mammals, and so they take a lot of pressure off other species, a lot of the salmonid species coming up the river, too. And so they provide a buffer there's just had traditionally been such a mass of them in the river. And so seeing that in decline just points towards the decline of the whole ecosystem of the river.
That raises an issue I noticed in one of the papers I was reading about traditional ecological knowledge on the Klamath. And one of the traditional folks had described how really abundant spawned out lamprey would get washed down the river at the bottom and fall down into the deep sturgeon holes and were a key food source for the big sturgeon. So as you're going forward and doing this research, what are the most important things that we don't know about lamprey? And what are the coolest things you think about this these strange fish?
I guess, you know, one of the major information gaps that we're dealing with right now is what happens in the marine environment. When these fish migrate out into the ocean, they're about the size of a diameter of a pencil, so it makes it fairly difficult to insert any sort of tag or anything like that. So our understanding of their distribution, their feeding, all the factors that affect lampreys in the marine environment is very poorly understood. So I guess that's, you know, one of the biggest information gaps that we're dealing with right now.
Well, Damon, you've actually helped to address what was formerly one of the big questions about lamprey, which is whether they are more like salmon in sort of having a home stream or whether they actually sort of come home to wherever there's an opportunity, whether they're sort of a more heterogeneous fish.
Yeah, my thesis work at Humboldt State University's fisheries department was on understanding the population dynamics of Pacific lampreys along the coast. We surveyed somewhere around 80 populations of lampreys from northern British Columbia to as far south as we could find them in California, and comparing genetic signatures among populations. And what we found is much different than the salmonid model, where we get these kind of unique genetic signatures in different regions or different streams or even between different run timings.
Right.
We found little to no differences despite 2,700 kilometers of stream. So indicating there was enough gene flow among populations, enough migrants going across basins that it kind of homogenized that genetic signature. And there's been we just completed a follow-up study that used a higher resolution genetic marker to show a very similar pattern. So we're kind of working under a different model here. Work on the Great Lakes sea lamprey found that sea lampreys homing to their natal stream would key into larval pheromones or the scent of their young, and it's what's called the suitable river strategy, which the scent of young lampreys guides adult lampreys into suitable habitats. And our working hypothesis on the West Coast for Pacific lampreys is that they follow a very similar pattern.
Which raises the question that if we were to accidentally or some other ways knock out the population of lamprey in a stream or in a reach, the adults might not get the signal to come back there.
Right. And I'm not sure that is the only, I'm not sure that's the only factor that guides lamprey migration. There may be other cues or maybe straying that would recolonize areas like that. For example, British Columbia up to Alaska was covered in large glaciers, but that's been all recolonized
right.
with Pacific lamprey. So there's other factors at play here. But what it does mean is, you know, our traditional salmonid model is that salmon are born in a stream, they migrate out to the ocean and come back to that stream. So efforts to improve conditions in that one stream or threats to individuals in that stream only has the largest effect on that population. Lampreys, it's a different situation. For example, our current model with lampreys is that they migrate out into the ocean and then it's kind of a regional subpopulation, so they're sharing. So it kind of links all these streams together in their conservation efforts and links populations together. So it really will require a concerted conservation effort coordinated among basins to work towards improving populations.
Stephen, Vincent, you want to talk about the most important things we don't know about lamprey from your point of view on the river?
Well, just one other thing real quick that Damon started to mention is just the efforts across basins, I think, is really important, and to be able to collaborate, because what happens on one river and one basin is going to affect those on the other. So I think that's something that we're moving towards. I think there's a lot of cool things about lamprey. Like, we spoke to how they fill so many roles in the ecosystem. You know, they're both predator and prey to the same species. They're so little understood. And one of the things that we'd like to learn about them, too, is where they spend their time. If they're coming in and spending a year before spawning, we don't really know where that might occur. So we're seeking some funding to do some radio telemetry studies of actually tagging the fish as they come in and trying to get more of an understanding that way too. And all of this gearing towards helping them revive to help them become a staple again of traditional diets, you know, not just to bring the fish in to study them, but because they're tied up with the human inhabitants of the area, and it's all one big ecosystem. So,
yeah. One thing we didn't talk about was the meeting that was just held to sort of bring folks together who are working on lamprey. Maybe you could talk briefly about that and how that ties in with these larger efforts.
Right. As part of the Pacific Lamprey Conservation Initiative, we're reaching out to different groups, you know, throughout the range of Pacific lamprey. And last week, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission.
So this was in mid-June, yeah.
Hosted a Lamprey Summit 3. It was a third of these summits, and it brought together individuals from different agencies, tribes, non-governmental organizations, and from other walks of life, too, all coming together to discuss the issues that lampreys are facing and pave a way forward on how we can work together to conserve lampreys. And part of the summit was to sign a conservation agreement. And so groups came together and signed this document indicating we're all going to do our best to work together to bring Pacific lampreys back to historical populations.
Damon, one of the other things the Fish and Wildlife Service is doing is working with a character called Luna the Lamprey. Who is she? What's she doing? What's that about?
Luna the Lamprey, one of the threats that we see to Pacific lamprey populations is the lack of awareness. And not just in the general public, but even within biologists. And Luna the Lamprey is one of the tools the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is using to reach out to stakeholders to try and get another connection through Facebook. It's actually a character on Facebook that you can become friends with. And what it leads to is a discussion about conservation efforts and different interesting facts about lampreys around the country. So it's an interesting way to approach the outreach for Pacific lamprey conservation.
So a fish that's, what did you say, 300 and some million years old is up on the latest social media.
Closer to like 450 million years old.
Wow. What a world we live in. Any other good resources for folks interested in lamprey?
There's quite a bit of resources out there. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has a website for the Pacific Lamprey Conservation Initiative where we have different outreach tools, information about what we're working on. I'd also like to mention the Tribal Wildlife Grant Program that has provided funding for lamprey research programs, including the project that the Wiat Tribe is working on, and the Arcata Fish and Wildlife Service webpage. All these post information about latest lamprey events, so check it out.
Great. I'll try to get those posted onto the Friends of the Eel website and the North Coast Environmental Center website as well.
And the Wiat Tribe Environmental Department also has its own Facebook page. Not that much about lamprey on it, but there are some cool video and pictures, including one of Vincent hooking a lamprey. So it's kind of fun watching.
So thanks so much, guys, for coming in. Again, this has been the Eco News Report. I'm Scott Greason with Friends of the Eel River. I've had with me in the studio Stephen Coleman and Vincent DiMarzo with the Wiat Tribe's Environmental Department, and Damon Goodman from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Arcata office. Really appreciate your time today, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Scott.
If you'd like to replay this interview or share it with others, you can go to the public affairs page on the KHSU website at khsu.org, where these programs are archived for 2 weeks after they air. Thereafter, the files from recent shows are posted on the North Coast Environmental Center's website at yournec.org. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call KHSU's listener comment line at 826-6089. The Eco News Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center, and is engineered by the indefatigable Fred McLaughlin. Join us again next Thursday at 1:30 here on KHSU for the Eco News Report.